Everyone hits a bump in the road. What do you do with it? Be inspired as we explore the ways people experience, navigate, and manage the ups and downs and twists and turns in this road trip called life. Welcome to another episode of Bump in the Road. The basic podcast is always free. We also have a premium subscription called Bump 2 that lets you listen in on extended behind-the-scenes conversations with our guests. Check it out at www.bumpintheroad.us. Jeffrey Berwin describes himself not as a storyteller, but as a story sharer, because stories connect us on an emotional level that simple facts cannot. I would describe Jeffrey as a story master, and you are in for a treat as Jeffrey and I talk about the power of story and why it matters. Please welcome Jeffrey Berwin to Bump in the Road. Jeffrey, welcome to Bump in the Road. If you would, tell us your story.
Thanks, Pat. I would love to. Where to start, right? In any story. Well, I was born. No, we're not going to do that. Well, I would say the first bump in the road is I actually never knew my dad. And so I really was brought up by my grandparents. And my grandmother loved the theater. My grandfather was in business. They both loved opera. And that's what they really introduced me to. So naturally, when I get into college, I'm torn between a business major and a fine arts major. And the first bump, Pat, is I take economics 101, thinking, well, this will be great. And the professor was an idiot. And he said, first thing out of his mouth is like, just to let you know that the field of economics is all theory. And I was done. Then I took an art history class and that was awesome. I think it was the art history 101 and Egypt and all the great stuff over the eons. So I became an art history major, get out of school, went to George Washington University and started running our family retail stores outside of the Philadelphia area. I did that for a while, but they were already coming to the end of their natural cycle. So I found myself in my late 30s closing these stores and starting to ask myself, what am I going to do with my life? And it was really a dark time, as anybody who has to reinvent themselves know. And I thought, oh, you were an art history major. How helpful will that be? What are you going to start a gallery? And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. But given that I had the business side and the artistic side, and I live in the Philadelphia area, Philadelphia is amazing in so many ways, including the arts. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. So here I am in my young 40s, and I'm like, well, you know, I sold my house, and I said, let me start a little live theater company in this little suburban town that was struggling outside in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And so, you know, I was really waiting. I don't know what I was trying to do, but I had a divine inspiration, maybe, because it just came to me out of nowhere, start a theater here. Went to the mayor of the town. I said, let's do a theater to help this town come together. It was divided politically, economically, racially. And I remember she jumped up on her dining room table and went, let's do it. I'm like, okay. And that's where the problems really started, because who knew what they were doing? Started a theater. I called it Celebration Theater. And we did a lot of shows that were just family-oriented, like A Christmas Carol, Miracle on 34th Street, but everything was a little outside of the box. We did unusual things, like we took over a working train station for one of our shows. We did ghost tours during a Halloween show around the town. It brought the town together. And my proudest moment with that was doing Miracle on 34th Street, which I directed. And in this one production, every night sold out. There were Democrats and Republicans, gays and straights, whites and blacks, grandparents and grandchildren. And I saw and witnessed the power of the arts in a healthy way to bring people to find that middle ground where people can be with each other and know each other and do something productive. And that was very foundational. So during all this, I'm not earning a penny. I'm doing a little side work with a company I'm now fully working with as their head coach, Author Success. But it was a very dark time because I knew I was trying to reinvent, slowly going broke. So to the outer world, everything's gone great. And I even created a mascot, Lord Lansdowne, because the town was named Lansdowne. And I walked around the town in a sash and a 19th century tuxedo. It was crazy. But it was getting attention. But I was really like, what am I going to do here? And I would say the darkest moment was, you know, selling that house, trying to do this theater, self-funding it. What would happen here? And my best friend, who I now have a 33-year relationship with, we tend to do boys' nights. And his wife would always say, go get out of here. Like, go do a boys' night. You need a boys' night. And I remember after dinner, we sat in my living room, and I just looked at him and poured my heart out. I just, you know, I'm hope. I have no hope. I have no idea. I feel bankrupt, not only financially, but of hope. And you know what turned it around, Pat, was he looked me in the eye. His eyes teared up, and he just emotionally came alongside him, and he looked and he just said, I believe in you. You can do, you're so talented. You can do anything you want. I had no idea what to do, but that compassion by my closest friend was the pivot. And like a week later, I was reading a spiritual book and I saw one line, because I work with authors all the time and I love the power of a reframe, or just one line can make a difference. And in this book, it said, God can't drive a parked car. And I went, yeah, I saw myself in that one sentence story. I saw myself in that story. I'm like, yeah, I'm parked. So between my friend who said, just do something, get in motion, and that one sentence, God can't drive a parked car, it was the pivotal point, and it led to all these things. So did the theater for a while, got on the radar of a wonderful nonprofit called Historic Philadelphia, Inc., which partners with the National Park Service. And their job is to provide things that entertain the tourists to come to the historic district to see the Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell and so forth, but to do it in an engaging way. And they had recently been mandated by the governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell, to start a program that had never existed called Once Upon a Nation. And they tapped me. You know, they didn't know I was trying to reinvent my life, but they tapped me to be their very first artistic director / storyteller trainer. I didn't know what the heck I was doing, but they teamed me with a historian and a whole thing, and we went for it. So now when you start, all of you in business know that when you start something new, and even if it's not in business, any project, you do what is called a soft start. You know, right, Pat? You just test it with a small group. You don't go public. Not this group. So we figured out some stories that we thought might work. And we're going to launch it in June, I think, of 2005. And this organization decides not to do a soft start. Let's do it via a press conference. And the minute I hear that, I went, no. And I know, let's invite the governor because it's his idea. And I went, no. So the day arrives. It's a beautiful May morning at the Free Quaker Meeting House right down the street from Independence Hall and the Liberty Bell. A little brick building, colonial era. The Free Quakers were actually Quakers that would be willing to fight Britain. That's why they're called Free Quakers. And the time arrives for the press conference. TV cameras roll in. Journalists from around the country roll in. I've trained a storyteller to deliver a sample story. And now when I get nervous, my upper lip sweats. And I have to keep wiping perspiration with the upper lip. And it's sweating profusely. We're waiting. Finally, the governor pulls in. He opens the doors. There's bodyguards. He's a very nice guy. So he's shaking hands and everybody's laughing. And he sits down. The head of the organization makes a couple opening remarks. And now it's time for Jill, one of my storytellers, to get up there and tell a story. Now, here's the thing. If it bombed, game over. The governor has funded this. He's looking at it. He has no idea what he's about to hear. The TV cameras are rolling. This is a live press conference. And at the end of the day, even though I had a team, it was on me, let it work or not. So Jill takes center stage and starts telling the story of during the British occupation of Philadelphia. So interestingly, if an enemy occupies a capital city, the war should be over. But Philadelphia definitely had a lot of patriots, but it also had loyalists that wanted to stay British. So Jill starts telling the story of Lydia Darrah, an older Quaker lady whose house has been commandeered by the British High Command. And one night she sneaks downstairs because she hears a meeting going on and her ear is to the keyhole. And she overhears them planning a surprise attack on George Washington's army, then at White Marsh. This is before Valley Forge. So Jill is starting to unfold the story, which we carefully created and scripted. And I'm not watching the storyteller because I know what she's going to do. I'm watching the governor because he's the audience. And initially, I'm horrified and my lip is now sweating again because I see him glancing at his BlackBerry. Remember BlackBerries? And listening to his assistants who are sitting on either side and glancing at the story. He's a busy guy. He's a governor of a powerful state. And I'm like, is this going to work? And as you know, the hidden story is I was trying to reinvent my life. And it was hinging on this moment. It really was. Not only for the product, Once Upon a Nation Storytelling, but for me. And only I knew that. So Jill is telling the story. Lydia gets a bag of flour, pretend, and a pass to get outside Philly to try to warn Washington's army in time before the British attack. And she's on this dusty road, praying to God she'll get there in time, gets past the British sentries. She can hear their cavalry starting to get on their horses. And she just looks to the sky and just, I hope I can get there. She's a patriot. And I'm continuing to watch the governor. He's still multitasking, still looking at his BlackBerry. I'm still swiping the perspiration off my lip. And we get to the heart of the story. And stories should be crafted very carefully and even tested. But in the heart of the story, Jill, as she told the story about Lydia, just paused. And just this heartfelt statement. And I saw the governor of Pennsylvania do something that completely changed my life and launched the program. Because what he did is he put down his BlackBerry, he shushed his assistants, and he leaned forward and never took his eyes off the storyteller for the rest of the story. And I remember standing in the back of the room, seeing that happen. And at the time, what did I just see there? You're telling me that a story without any visual aids and no props, just told, would have a governor, a politician, put down his BlackBerry and stop multitasking? So now, when I tell that story, sometimes people say, so what happened? I'm like, well, do we speak with a British accent? No, we don't. We clearly won the revolution. She got there in time. And so we launched the program. We almost instantly won an award for repackaging American history in ways that families would love. Within weeks, one of our first testimonials came in from a little 8-year-old boy who said, you know, before I came to Philadelphia and saw your storytellers, I hated American history, but I heard one of your stories, and now I'm back here playing with my sister in our swimming pool as a Quaker spy. And we burst into laughter saying, so not accurate, but so awesome. And that program has now been running for 18 years, and I've been their artistic director for most of those seasons, and I'm so proud of it. And really, that experience launched me on an inquiry, really a quest to discover, why did that happen? What is it about a story that is what I now call primal technology? And what's happening to the brain? Why a story without slides and PowerPoint, without anything, could grab somebody's attention? Because this Once Upon a Nation story, here's what it looks like. It's during the summer. It's free. There are semicircular storytelling benches, wood benches, with a sign that says Once Upon a Nation, stories free. And we have a whole cast of trained storytellers not in costume, because that's a barrier. So they're just wearing a branded polo shirt, khakis. And I train them on 5-story scripts that have been tested and evolve over time. Time and again, families, kids, people who don't know each other just love it. I mean, the Philadelphians have now experienced it so much. It's like, you're back! And tourists from around the world experience it. So to finish, I would say that after now 18 years working on stories now with authors and speakers, and I help people with TED Talks and so forth, I call storytelling the glue which holds everything together for you as a business owner, as a nonprofit person, as a human. Stories keep us together, and they work. In this day of high technology, they're more powerful than the phone you're walking around with in your pocket.
That's impressive. Primal technology, talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, think about, I remember hearing somebody say, we are a storytelling species. If you think about it, we like to think we're so smart, right? And that's very limited. The reality is we're still creatures. We live on this earth as a creature, just like a dog, a cat, a tiger, an elephant. We're still creatures. We're sensory beings, right? And dating way back to how long have we been around, a couple 100,000 years, it's sort of, to use the cliche, we're around the campfire scanning the horizon to make sure some tiger is not to eat, about to eat us. But the way we've always processed the world is through sharing stories around the fire. And so if we've been doing that for millennia, our brains are wired for this. Once MRI started studying the brain, they actually studied what happens to the brain when straight information versus stories are happening, and the oldest parts of our brain light up like a Christmas tree when we hear a story. And actually, we don't need the science behind it to just know that we grew up with stories. We told each other stories, bedtime, everything is stories, and we like stories. Go to any church, synagogue, or organization that is doing a sermon or preaching something or sharing, you could see the people in the congregation leaning in and eyes sparkling when a story is being told and leaning back when they're being taught something. This is physiological. So there's terms out there like neural coupling, mirroring. The brain is actually wired, hardwired to want to join your story. It's not narcissism. It's actually our brains, in a way, our tribal brain, right? We are all humans together. It's very superficial what separates us. And we're all in this. So if our brains are wired to share our experiences through stories, then that's great. Here's what a story is not. It's not a list of your accomplishments. It's not a narrative version of your resume. I did this, then I did that, then I did this. Who cares? You know, a good friend of mine says, nobody wants to see your home movies. But what they do want is hear stories about pivotal moments in your life and my life that they can relate to. So the longer version of that story I shared with you, which I could tell in like a minute if I had to, that's called an origin story. And so each of us who are in the helping professions or teachers or coaches, business founders, you want to have your origin story. It's the why you do what you do. Why does Pat's care so much to help people navigate the bumps in their road? Why does Jeffrey want so much to help people tell their story so that they can make that personal, emotional connection to their audiences, to their readers? So the primal technology is, to say it another way, I believe that this magnificent word called imagination is sort of like a muscle somewhere in us. And modern technology, the imagination doesn't have to work very hard. It sort of sits there quietly because everything's on a screen. But when we tell a story just out of our mouth and we're just hearing it, the ancient imagination is going, it's great. We're happy. And think about the root word of imagination. It's image. So you're painting pictures through your stories. You're taking us back in time. For me, these little touches like my wiping my upper lip and the governor putting down his phone and all these things. To master storytelling, if I had to give you my best tip, it's paint pictures with your mouth. Images, imagery. It's like a movie. You're verbalizing like a mini movie that the imagination now enters into. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. I think emotionally we're all the same, and that's part of the resonance of stories. Everybody feels happy or pain or uncertainty, and we can all relate to that circumstance, even if we can't relate to specifically what your individual experience might be.
So when you select your stories, you're depending who you're telling them to, right? You're thinking about your audience or your readers or your followers. Exactly, Pat. Where do they... What are they struggling with that you struggled with too? And in this case, for our discussions, what I work with people on is nonfiction. It's their real life stories, whether theirs or others. I'm not talking about fiction in this case. Our stories have immense power to build connections for people to relate to. So you want to use your stories to build that heart-to-heart connection with your followers. You also could use stories to illustrate teaching points. By saying, for example, then you tell a story of somebody you helped or even somebody you don't know. So, one of the takeaways I would offer is that people remember stories more than information. That's how we're wired. They've done studies that in a typical business meeting, if the presenter is teaching something but also telling stories, a third of the room will remember the information, but two-thirds of the room will remember the story that was told. And that's true in books. That's true as a really in speaking and interviews, like tell that story when da 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 da. That's actually what a signature story is when you're asked, you know, could you speak to my group and could you tell that story? That's a signature story. So it's a rich vein of possibilities, but I really would invite your followers to understand that their stories have power. They don't have to be big deal stories. They just build connections with people and makes you want people to hear your stories going, me too, in some aspect of it.
Now, I don't think the stories have to be huge stories in order to connect. Actually, I would say that many people share a detail of their story. One of the common themes that I come up with a lot in certain markets is isolation. That's a really powerful, emotionally bonding experience for people. And it might happen because they went through a divorce. It might happen because they went through an illness. It could happen for any variety of reasons. But that emotion really resonates with an audience.
I totally agree. That's how you could figure out how to tell your story or which stories to use, is think about what is the audience typically, what solutions are they looking for something, and how do they feel? And I agree completely what's the foundational existential stuff we all share? Who am I? Is my life worth living? What's my legacy? Why do I feel so alone? It's the quote negative stuff, but it's actually not. Life is hard. Life is difficult, as M. Scott Peck wrote, right? And so we connect to each other through saying, yeah, it ain't easy, but I'm going to still give you hope. There's still possibilities. Still, as long as you're breathing, stuff might happen. But I think we connect with each other through the existential lack of things. So many people feel like their life is not worth living. That's tragic. Or they're not making a difference. Or they feel, as you said, alone. Yeah, welcome to being human.
Yeah,
and stories connect us to each other.
Yeah, and while those are seemingly negative emotions, I would actually argue that they're emotions of pain. And when you can release that pain, on the other side of that is this wondrous, terrific world of brightness and possibility. And I think that if you can go through that shift a few times, you can learn to look for that possibility in almost any situation.
Yeah. You know, Pat, I came across a phrase during COVID that I found fascinating, because I'm a little type A and I want to be in control and I want to be safe, all these things, right? And COVID shook all that up. And I loved it when a friend said to mine, I shared that anxiety with him, and they said, this is brilliant, actually. He said, what's your relationship with uncertainty? And I love a reframe. I'm like, that's a great, I instantly got it. I started doing some research and I came across a very interesting phrase, liminal space. Liminal space are the times in our lives of uncertainty. Gray area, I don't know what to do next. I'm in the desert. If you think about major situations in the Bible, the Israelites out of Egypt, 40 years in the desert. That was liminal space. When we're between jobs, it's liminal space. Between marriages, between anything, we're not sure and we can't see our way, liminal space. And what I took from his remark and then researching liminal space, I'm like, okay, here's what I would say it is. It's the hallways between rooms. And a hallway is still a room. A hallway can have paintings on it, and you could be in the hallway. And so when you realize that we all deal with issues and we all struggle with stuff, and sometimes it's dark points in our life, the dark night of the soul, but we can come out of it. We could be hopeful. We don't need to dash into that next room. We could be comfortable with uncertainty, because in the uncertainty, if I wasn't sure that story would work for the governor of Pennsylvania. It was in liminal space, trying to reinvent my life, trying to help this organization launch a project that nobody had ever seen before. And then when he put his cell phone down, there was the next room. There was a door to the future just opened up. And so all we can do in the times of uncertainty is be maybe less concerned with a certain goal or outcome. Goal setting can be very toxic, actually. Better to be an explorer than to say, I'm going for that, and close off all other possibilities. So the takeaway for COVID, for me, at least, as someone who could deal with anxiety and uncertainty, is be okay with liminal space. it's also a room to itself. And you could just be there and allow stuff to happen and observe and explore stuff.
I've come to see uncertainty as possibility, actually, because you're in that, one of my friends calls that space the void, and you don't know where you're going. You're not sure where you've been. You just do not have a clue, and everything's all mixed up. But somewhere in that void, there's this infinite range of possibilities. So what do you want to choose? Because you can craft that moment, this moment, and the next moment to create what you want. So I have come to see uncertainty as a very creative space and a space of enormous possibility. I don't think it's always easy. Uncertainty and control kind of are the flip sides of that coin. And I think that society teaches us to always be in control, to always know what we're doing. I had one event that shook me up enormously. Speaking of control, I used to fly high-performance sailplanes. I was flying at Minden, which is one of the best places in the world to fly. I mean, massive updrafts. You can race down the spine of mountains. It's just amazing. There were two very prominent pilots flying one day, and they stalled one of their wings in a thermal, and they spun into the ground, hit at 200 miles an hour. And it shook up the entire aviation community because everybody has to believe that they have the ability to do this. Otherwise, why in the world would you go out in an airplane without an engine and fly hundreds of miles over unlandable terrain? It's insane. But it shook everybody. The event really shook everybody up, and it shook me up enormously and took me years to figure this out. And I think what shook me up was the issue of control. What do we really control? And if you let go of control, what is there? And one of the answers I came away with is there can be an immense amount of joy in being in the present right now, doing what you love to do. And what more is there than that?
Well, I have a little post-it right below my computer that I just glanced at, and it says relinquish control, which is my note to self. Because I'm a coach and a consultant. I'll deal with hundreds and hundreds of people all year long giving them advice. What do I know? They're coming for me for, I can't control their life, their outcome. I can give advice and I know it's valued and help them tell their stories and help them. At the end of the day, there's very little control. And it's not a happy thought unless you're, like you said, in the moment, realizing we're alive, we're breathing. And, I love C.S. Lewis and the Narnia stories. And Aslan is a stand-in for Jesus Christ, actually. So they talk about Aslan, the lion, as not a safe lion. And I grew up not knowing the subtext behind those stories, but it's not safe out there. Nothing is predictable. Nothing is certain. And it's a call to be in the moment right now, relinquish control. And it seems paradoxical, but it's the way to happiness and contentment. Just let it go.
I agree. It is. I think life offers ongoing lessons in that regard.
Yeah. Right. We've all learned some lessons about it. And those lessons, I don't think, are ever fully learned. We keep working them out. And it's a practice, it's like, it doesn't mean that I could be looking at my little yellow post-it right now that says relinquish control, surrender Dorothy. But at the end of the day, I need to keep glancing at that and keep practicing it because we forget.
When it comes to telling stories, what advice would you give people? I often ask people to tell a story, and some people are so good at it. What makes a good storyteller?
Well, understand that it is everybody's wired for stories, but it's still a craft to work on. So most of us have somebody in our life, which can intimidate us, by the way. Oh, that person, that he or she is a storyteller. I can never tell stories. I hear all that all the time. Not true. We just have to give ourselves permission to think about we have stories to tell and that have value. First thing I love people to do is buy a new journal or create a spreadsheet, whatever you want, and just call it your story inventory. And I would love you to consider today, even if it's a blank piece of paper, just write down at the top of the page the time when, ... And look back on your life without judgment if you're ever going to use the story or not. Just think about key moments in your life, good, bad, and different. Achievements, travel, pets, relationships, anything. Challenges, spiritual awakenings, you name it. And just put down the time when, the time when, the time when. Then take a look at that list and keep adding to it, because you'll realize you have hundreds of stories, thousands in your life if you're over 10 years old. And some of those stories may have teaching points, lessons that could be eventually in a book, eventually in a speech or workshop, eventually in a media interview, whatever it is. Many of our stories can have lessons that we want to pass on to others and become a teaching point. So I like people to think about, number one, you have stories that matter. That's the first thing, because people need to give themselves permissions to actually tell their stories. Then you start your story inventory. And is there a lesson attached to the story? And just know that and keep adding to the list. Some techniques, I've already talked about the power of descriptive language. You want to focus your stories on big moments, just like a good memoir, if it was a book. A good memoir should not be, I did this, then I did that, and then you're lulling the reader to, you know, it's to sleep. No, it's focusing on exciting big moments where something, a transformation is about to happen or something big experience. The story stays there. So use descriptive language, use dialogue in a story. Take us back in time. Avoid teaching when you're telling a story. Teaching inhabits a different part of the brain. So just tell your story and then teach afterwards, or teach before, tell the story. When you tell, verbalize a story, pardon me, especially, view it as this bubble or balloon that you're blowing up, and knowing that the reader or the listener is starting to join the story by how their brain is wired, you're sharing a story versus telling actually. But if you interrupt yourself by teaching something, or going off into a tangent, you've burst that bubble or burst that balloon. So a lot of people I work with, that's their big aha, especially scientists and people in the medical profession. Most of us are not taught how to tell stories. And they go, oh, that's where my case study went wrong. Pardon me. In the middle of the story, I started teaching and people leaned back and went, ugh, you know, on a certain level. So to repeat, descriptive language, focus a story on big moments, allow natural suspense to build. A story is really not a story without trouble and obstacles to be overcome. You know, think about the fundamentals. You and I have already talked about the emotional grounding of the story. What's it about? Is it about reinventing yourself, overcoming a challenge, having a desire yet to be met? What's my purpose? Why am I here? And create mini movies by how you describe things. And avoid teaching intentions. And again, what's great about storytelling is test it. You know, try it out on people. See where they react and where they don't. And use your stories. It's a living, breathing thing. With the Once Upon a Nation program, we've told certain stories now for 18 years. We tweak them every time because we're observing reactions. Living, breathing thing. A lot of scientists say science is never settled. I would say stories are never settled. And you just keep playing with them and enjoying them. This is actually fun, by the way. Telling your stories is fun. So go have fun.
Thank you for listening. I hope you'll support this podcast by becoming a Bump2 subscriber. Buy us a cup of coffee. It's your support that makes this podcast and website possible. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path. Because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life.